The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Hello, and welcome to this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman with the Virginia Voice. Our first article is from The Best American Travel Writing. Why Should a Melon Cost as Much as a Car? By Bianca Bosker. My journey to the heart of the muskmelon cult started with a strawberry. A few years ago, I was in a dimly lit Tokyo restaurant that served more courses than it had seats, where I dined on anatomical selections. I couldn't name belonging to species I didn't know existed, prepared by a chef whose elegance with a knife resembled ballet more than cooking. Back home, an American version of this feast might have ended with a procession of desserts, a palate cleanser of grapefruit semifreddo, a heftier dessert entree of coffee buttercream with dark chocolate ganache, then a post-dessert dessert of truffles and sugar-coated jellies, plus a pastry to take home for later. But at my dinner in Tokyo, when the chef presented my dessert, I found a single sliced strawberry served alone on a plate. Biting into one sliver of the fruit, I had the sense I was tasting in color for the first time. The strawberry was perfumed. It tasted of roses, honey, and a kiss, and it made absolutely no sense. Where did it come from? What made it special? Why only one? I discovered my strawberry was both more special than I thought and less unique. In Tokyo's department stores, just a few floors down from Dior dresses, I stumbled on shrink-wrapped boxes of strawberries, presented in soft lighting and on pedestals, being sold for $5 apiece. A bargain when I realized the best command $500 each. And it wasn't just the strawberries. Japan had elevated all kinds of fruit to Bergen bag status. In the subway, I spent $12 on fewer than a dozen grapes. Again, cheap considering a bunch sold for $11,000 in 2016. I stared dumbfounded at YouTube fruit porn showing juicy hunks of yellow flesh being sliced from rare egg-of-the-sun mangoes, $2,700 each for top specimens. And then I learned about the king of fruit, muskmelons, reticulated spheres of melting sweetness that could command $27,000 a pair, earn TV specials in Japan, and wore tiny hats while ripening to save their pale flesh from sunburn. But why? Does the world need melons that cost as much as a car? It's like asking in America, why do you high-five, said a Japanese friend, one of many I hounded for answers, and one of many who shrugged in response. We have never questioned why the fruit is so expensive. But, she added, since you asked about it, I started to realize, why? By all accounts, Japan's obsession with luxury fruits begins with Senbikiya, the country's largest and oldest high-end fruit provider. So, ahead of a trip to Japan last fall, I emailed Senbikiya to see about arranging an interview at their flagship store in Nihonbashi, a tiny part of downtown Tokyo that's home to luxury hotels, lacquer bowl purveyors, and washi paper boutiques. When I arrive in the marble lobby of the high-rise to which I've been directed, I pass back and forth in front of what appears to be a jewelry store before finally realizing it is Senbikiya. Dark, polished wood and sheer curtains line the walls, and sparkling chandeliers shaped like exploding snowflakes twinkle overhead. Glass display cases hold meticulous rows of fruit, tended by prim women in starched black uniforms and berets, ready to share anecdotes about the sweetness of the pears, $19 each, or Sekaiichi apples, $24 each. Middle-aged women with Chanel bags and teased updos inspect plump, jade-colored Sito grapes swaddled in crisp white paper, while their husbands admire the altar-like case of muskmelons at the center of the floor, each one perched on its own wooden box, lined with mint-colored paper, $125 each. Each fruit species boasts its own full-color brochure with tasting notes to rival those for first-grown Bordeaux. The skin is thin, while the seedless pulp is moderately firm, reads the card for the Suiho grape. Eaters can savor a delicate sweetness and aroma with a refreshing aftertaste. One of the salespeople informs me that around 80% of customers buy Senbikiya's fruit to give as gifts. The store gets busier around July, when tradition dictates offering a chugun gift to people to whom you feel indebted, and in December, when it's customary to give a Sibo present for similar reasons. Senbikiya can sell as many as 200 muskmelons a day, which might be offered to bosses, clients, teachers, parents, or doctors. How do you choose what fruit to give? If the boss loves apples more than melon, it's better to give him an apple than a melon, right? The salesman advises. But if the boss likes higher glamour fruits, then maybe it's better to go for the melon. An emissary from Senbikiya's corporate office whisk me upstairs to the company's fruit parlor, a cafe serving elaborate ice cream sundaes and fruitscapes made with whatever ripe produce hasn't sold in the store. As Vivaldi's Four Seasons plays, and we sip ice water from wine glasses, Tsuyoshi Monozumi, a former fruit parlor chef who now oversees all 16 Senbikiya branches, walks me through the company's history. Through my translator, he explained that Senbikiya got its start in 1834, when a samurai, Benzo Oshima, set up a stand right here in Nihonbashi peddling, ironically, discount fruit. In the latter half of the century, the savvy wife of one of Oshima's descendants decided to invert the business model. Through her tea ceremony master, who was well-connected in Japan's upper echelons, Senbikiya scored an appointment as fruit purveyor of the Tokugawa shogunate, the country's last feudal military government. It governed until 1868. Subsequent generations of Oshimas, who still run the company today, continuously refined the quality of their produce, importing exotic selections from abroad, abandoning farming in favor of culling the best fruit from across the country's top growers, creating the forerunner to the fruit parlor, and opening new stores across Japan. This is interesting, but unsatisfactory. Plenty of British merchants supply coffee or gin to the royal family without inflating their prices to stratospheric levels. What gives? Monozumi struggles for an answer, finally settling on the explanation that people in Japan are simply more concerned than foreigners with quality. Before, a long time ago, we were like the United States or Southeast Asia. People were eating apples walking down the street, or they'd have a mountain of apples in the corner of the street selling it, he says, making me feel like a barbarian. But people are asking for better quality, better taste. The reason why Sambiquia has high-end fruits is they are just answering the customer's expectations, the customer's needs. It may have helped, he notes, that we, as Japanese, are good at putting the quality in a product. Eric Rath, a professor of pre-modern Japanese history and author of Japan's Cuisines, offers a slightly different account. During the Tokugawa period, wealthy merchants competed to outbid each other to buy the first produce of the season, hashiri, snapping up that year's inaugural tuna or bunch of grapes, offered not only bragging rights. The first harvest of the season was also thought to taste better than the food that followed, and to extend the eater's lifespan by 75 days. Rath notes the centuries-old fad continues today. The muskmelons and grapes that fetch five figures at auctions are all hashiri. At the same time, fruit has long played a starring role in Japanese ceremonial gift-giving. 13th and 14th century samurais presented tangerines, or that king of fruits, melons, to the shogun, their chief, as a show of loyalty, while in the fall, farmers gifted fruit and other edibles to neighbors with the expectation they'd return the favor by helping with the harvest. Giving fruit, in other words, represented an expectation of a return in the form of service, Rath writes in an email. The modern version, chugun, is a similar practice that reaffirms the expectations of relationships. In a sense, bananas, like engagement rings, are symbols of a bond, which helps explain the effort to go beyond dole. If the price is high, the customer is excited, thrilled about the price, says Monozimi. But expensive for a reason? Or expensive purely to show you've splurged on your boss? Monozumi leads me back downstairs to Sambiquia store and proudly shows me the muskmelons. He gives me a moment to bask in the splendor of the store's specimens, which are their best seller. I'm not sure what I'm looking for. They look like any other melon, beige, topped by green stems splayed like TV antenna. Like Miss America contestants, each one wears a white sash around its center, emblazoned with the words, Musk Melon Special Selection. Monozumi details the journey these pampered lemon melons undertake before arriving at the store. First, the best melon seeds, new strains of which are bred every year, are planted in soil bedding, not the ground, and kept cozy inside greenhouses, outfitted with air conditioners and heaters, to ensure the melons stay warm, but not too warm year-round. When the vines begin to bud, scrawny flowers are ruthlessly removed, and champion farmers hand-pollinate the flowers, using a tiny paintbrush to move pollen between the blooms, like overgrown humanoid beads. Yet another culling happens once the baby melons reach fist size. Farmers pluck all but the most promising fruit, leaving only a single melon per vine, to concentrate the plant's nutrients in one uber-juicy fruit. These remaining muskmelons each get an outfit, a string tied around their stems to prevent them from falling as they ripen, plus their signature hat, black cone shape, to prevent sunburn. As the melon grows, cracks develop in its exterior. Think melon stretch marks, caused by insides expanding faster than the skin, and sugary juices flow into the cracks, creating elegant reticulation that makes it look as though the fruit has been caught in a khaki-colored net. The finer the reticulation, the sweeter and juicier the melon, experts say. To make the melons even sweeter, farmers don white cotton gloves and give each individual fruit a vigorous melon massage, what Sembikia's website refers to as a ball wiping, by rubbing the outside of the fruit. Champion growers are so enthusiastic with this ball wiping, they get holes in their gloves and go through multiple pairs per crop. When at last the melons are picked, they will be graded on their shape, ideally perfectly spherical, sweetness, high, reticulation, preferably tiny and delicate, and scent, intoxicating. The best will be awarded the top Fuji designation, but only 3% of a crop might qualify. The fruit travels to Tokyo's Ota market, where middlemen hired by Sembikia purchase the finest specimens for the company, which in turn selects the best of the bunch. For example, if Sembikia orders one case of apples, the middleman will look for three cases of apples. They will pick the best ones to make one case, and then they will give it to the Sembikia, explains Monozumi. And then Sembikia will pick the best apple from that one case to their store. The apple rejects get returned to the middleman, or, if their imperfections are merely superficial, they are cooked into the sauces and jams that Sembikia also sells. Later, I wait in line for a seat at the Sembikia fruit parlor, which at 4 o'clock p.m. on a Wednesday is packed with little old ladies in flowered cardigans and mother-daughter duos weighed down with designer shopping bags. When I'm finally shown to a table, I order Sembikia's signature $22 fruit plate. It comes with 1/3 of a banana, 3 slices each of persimmon, orange, pineapple, kiwi, and mango, 3 partially peeled grapes, and 1.5-inch wide rind of muskmelon. I began with a taste of what Monozumi referred to as more like a commoner's fruit, the banana. It has a rich, nutty flavor with the most concentrated banana essence I've ever tasted. The mango is melt-in-your-mouth delicious. The grapes a revelation. I saved the muskmelon for last, giddy to try it after hearing about all the melons that had been sacrificed to bring me this bite. It has a vague pumpkin odor and is served properly chilled, but it is a disappointment. It tastes like melon. Sweet, yes, but not especially so, even a little watery. It wasn't until later, back home in New York, that I fully appreciated the fruit I'd been served. I was at the grocery store, standing in front of a pile of lumpy, gray, misshapen orbs that, according to the sign in front of me, were cantaloupe, the closest most Americans will get to a muskmelon. They were scratched and asymmetrical and looked borderline grotesque in a way I'd never considered before. I thought back to Sembikia's stand of muskmelons, the sphere skin, a soft tan mesh over a mint-green smooth surface, reminded me of needlepoint, and I could understand why the French described them as embroidered. Like so much in Japan, something that initially seemed nonsensical, even trivial, had altered my definition of beauty. Even fruit could become art. Later, back home, I enviously watch YouTube videos of bloggers and TV hosts slicing into muskmelons or interviewing growers on raising the monarch of melons. I think only about melons, said one farmer, grinning. I'm a melon fool. I can relate. That was Why Should a Melon Cost as Much as a Car? By Bianca Bosker. Our next article is from TheGuardian.com. $200 Melons, How Japan's High-End Fruit Reveals Our Attitudes to Agriculture, Adam Law. November 4th, 2019. Australians are happy to pay for an expensive restaurant meal, but when it comes to farmers' labor, the price is rarely right. In the basement food halls of Japan's ritzy department stores, you'll find some of the world's most expensive fruit. High-end specimens produced for the domestic gift market that can fetch eye-watering prices. A single melon can sell for upwards of 15,000 yen, around 200 Australian dollars. A bunch of 15 or so grapes for 8,000 yen, around 105 Australian dollars. And premium white strawberries for 3,000 yen, 8 Australian dollars 40 each. Earlier this year, two Yubari King melons from Sapporo sold at auction for 5 million yen, nearly 70,000 Australian dollars. You can't read too much into that price, however. Just like the record-breaking tuna auctions in Tokyo, hugely inflated first-of-season auction prices are usually about rival food corporations bidding to trump competitors for the resulting free media coverage. Explanations for the high prices of premium Japanese fruit usually focus on the labor that goes into its production. Shizuoka's famed crown muskmelons are tended by hand for 100 days. Only a single fruit is allowed to grow on each vine, concentrating nutrients. They're rubbed with gloved hands to stimulate even growth and sweetness. On sunny days, they're fitted with caps to prevent sunburn. And when harvested, they're graded on shape and skin quality as one might for pearls. Perfectly round melons, free from blemishes, fetch the highest prices. Production cost aside, the important question is perhaps not why these fruits are so expensive, but why we find the prices so surprising. Some of us will pay hundreds of dollars for a meal that has been tricked up by a chef for a few hours, but balk at the same money for fruit that has been tended by a farmer for months. These views have history. In the Western world, the perceived value of produce has been shaped by the British agricultural revolution of the 17th to 19th centuries and the Green Revolution of the 1950s. These two periods saw dramatic increase in crop yields, leading to much lower prices. Most importantly, the effects of the Green Revolution shifted a larger share of the agricultural production for Western nations to the developing world. Subsistence farming gave way to offshore commercial monocultures for processing and export. Food production that was once part of daily life became hidden behind a corporate veil. The value of our food became linked not with its place in our culture, but with its supermarket price tag. In cultures where cuisine developed together with agriculture, before intensive farming, ingredients hold a higher status. In the Asian household I grew up in, we were told to finish our food, not because children in Africa were starving, but because idiomatically, every grain of rice represented a bead of sweat on a farmer's brow. Separating our culture and cuisine from agriculture has consequences beyond surprise at the cost of a melon. What we choose to eat and the value we ascribe to it is a question now more frequently answered by commerce than by nature. Proponents of more sustainable alternatives to industrial farming often suggest that the price of food, particularly meat, but also fruits and vegetables, should be higher to account for the economic externalities of that system, such as health and environmental costs. That such an approach could increasingly move natural foods out of the financial reach of lower-income households shows there are no easy solutions. One of the key drivers of the British agricultural revolution was discovering that growing turnips and clover could replenish soils better than allowing fields to lie fallow over winter. Animals could be fed on both, so production increased. It led to a boom in turnip recipes in Britain, and celebrated products such as spring lamb from the ewes, well fed over winter. These days, our tastemakers are more likely to be chefs and Instagrammers than farmers. What we choose to eat is driven by ideas that are no longer rooted in the ground. If we all want to eat quinoa we can't grow, and avocados we can't store, there are environmental and social consequences that follow. In Britain, spring lamb is no longer a product of 18th century field rotations. To meet demand, Australian and New Zealand hogget is shipped from the other side of the world to be served on brand rather than in season. Of course, $200 melons are hardly what we would consider sustainable commercial farming. But that we find it so hard to see high value in produce is telling. I tried one of those very expensive melons once. It was the best melon I have ever tasted. That was $200 melons, how Japan's high-end fruit reveals our attitudes to agriculture, by Adam Law. Japanese poetry about melons. If anyone comes, turn into frogs, O cooling melons, by Kobayashi Isa. Isa has just put some melons into a tub of water outside the house to cool them. As they float on the surface of the water, their green bellies remind him of frogs, just at the moment that he has the feeling of hesitation, of uneasiness at leaving them unguarded. This momentary seesawing of the mind makes the notion of melons turning into frogs more than merely fanciful. The humor also joins where it seems to separate. If anyone comes, turn into frogs, O cooling melons. Another haiku by Isa on melons. Oblivious of the gaze of the thief, melons in cool, by Kobayashi Isa. This essential immobility, imperturbability of the melons being cooled in cold water is here grasped and expressed through the contrast with the greediness of the would-be thief, probably Isa himself. Man and the world of things he is in are brought before the single eye of the mind. Oblivious of the gaze of the thief, melons in cool. Wet with morning dew and splotched with mud, the melon looks especially cool, by Matsuo Basho. All by itself, that beautiful melon, entirely self-sufficient, by Hattori Ransetsu. Mountain shade, body to rest a while as a melon field. Growing melons, I wish you were here in the evening coolness. Autumn coolness, each peeling with our hands, melons and eggplant. Beautiful, the core of the princess melon is already a queen. Neither evening nor morning belongs to the melon flower. Flowers and fruit, at the same time melons at their peak. That's all for this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.